So because he sees himself in every living being, therefore he has no relatives or enemies or friends because he's just seeing himself. Is that the idea? It's interesting, yeah. We'll read that later too, how Krishna he. Well, you're right. We'll get there. Yeah, he is definitely partial to his devotees, but here I'm talking about just why. What does it mean that the Lord has no relatives? Because we hear, like we have a good friend, Yashoda Nandana Das. Yashoda Nandana means the son of Mother Yashoda, meaning Krishna. At least has it seems like Krishna has a mother. There's so many names with Krishna and his relatives and his friends and his enemies. So. Yeah, try initial. Right, yeah, that's. Yeah, I mean, Krishna does have relatives and friends in the spiritual world, like real relatives and friends, but they're not. The whole point that you said that they're those relatives and those relationships are not due to ignorance. Like, we have a father and a mother, we happen to come across certain people, we have enemies and friends, but that relationship is due to ignorance because we identify with this body, and therefore I have a mother and I have a father and I have different relationships. So there's a difference between the kind of relationships we have, which are due to ignorance, and then the Supreme Lord has just e eternally. It's interesting too. They also have enemies, I guess, in the spiritual world. Like I'm thinking of, it's not actually enemies, but there are some like, I don't know, kind of different groups in the spiritual world. Like there's Radharani's group and Chandravali's camp, and then sometimes there's like a competition for who can get Krishna. So they're kind of like enemies, like spiritual kind of enemies. Like. Right around, he's, different devotees. They'll say, "Why are you going over to Chandravali's camp? Why don't you come with us?" And then there's different groups of gopas that might fight each other in different competitions and things. So I mean, there are clearly some kind of ideas of friends, enemies, and relatives in the spiritual world. So anyway, okay. I think Charyana should explain that nicely. Okay, so we'll continue. On the other hand, he is extremely kind and favorable to his devotees. And he is not at all satisfied with persons who are envious of his devotees. As the Lord himself confirms in Bhagavad Gita 9:29, Samoham sarva bhuteshu na me dvesyo stina priyaha ye bhajanti tu mam bhaktya mayi te teshu chapyaham. I envy no one, nor am I partial to anyone. I am equal to all. But whoever renders service unto me in devotion is a friend, is in me, and I am also a friend to him. The Supreme Lord has no enemy or friend, but he is inclined toward a devotee who always engages in his devotional service. Similarly, elsewhere in the Gita, the Lord says, Tan aham dvishata kruran, sangsareshu naradhanaman, kshipam yad ajushram ashubhan. Asurishveva yonishu. Those who are envious and mischievous, who are the lowest among men, are cast by me into the ocean of material existence, into various demoniac species of life. The Lord is extremely antagonistic toward those who are envious of his devotees. To protect his devotees, the Lord sometimes has to kill their enemies. For example, to protect Prahlad Maharaj, the Lord had to kill his enemy Hiranyakashipu. although Hiranyakashipu attained salvation because of being killed by the Lord. Since the Lord is the witness of everyone's activities, he witnesses the actions of the enemies of his devotees, and he is inclined to punish them. In other cases, however, he simply witnesses what the living entities do and gives the results of one's sinful or pious actions. Okay, so the verse begins, for this living entity, no one is dear, nor is anyone unfavorable. He makes no distinction between that which is his own and that which belongs to anyone else. So, well, first, who's speaking this? Who's speaking this verse? The jiva speaking this verse? I'm asking, yeah, is the jiva speaking this verse? Which jiva? The son of Chitraketu is speaking this verse? Does everyone agree? Yeah? It's the dead son who came back alive who's speaking this verse. Well, Vishwanath Chakravarti says that this is actually Narada Muni speaking. It's not the soul that was in the body of the son that came back and started speaking transcendental knowledge to King Chitraketu. It was actually Narada Muni who is speaking to King Chitraketu through the body of the son. So it's Narada Muni's way of... Well, no, it's Narada Muni. He's got all kinds of powers and mystical things. He can do whatever he wants, pretty much. So he orchestrated this whole experience for King Chitraketu to be able to receive transcendental knowledge, because it's pretty impactful if you see your dead son rise up and start speaking to you, you know, knowledge about temporary nature of relationships and transcendental knowledge. That's much more impactful to somebody than perhaps like a saintly person coming and saying, here's the way it is. That's also impactful, but Narada Muni thought King Chitraketu would get it better if Narada Muni spoke through the dead body of the son. That's I'm sure you'd probably be paying more attention if that happened. It would get your attention. So that's an interesting point. So then back to this verse, we hear about, for this living entity, no one is dear, nor is anyone unfavorable. He makes no distinctions, etc. So who is this living entity? Who is that referring to? The jiva who has come to the platform of self-realization. Okay. So any other guesses? Jiva. Okay. The self-realized jiva. Because it's saying here that he is not affected by friends or enemies, well-wishers or mischief mongers. So it seems like he's pretty elevated if it's referring to the jiva, the living entity. It's interesting because the previous verses, particularly the previous verse, it describes the relationship, kind of like the position of the jiva and the position of the Lord. There are certain qualities that are similar to both. Like in the previous verse, the it's described how the living entity and the Lord, they're both eternal, they're both unchanging, they're both subtle, they have similar qualities. You know, we heard the word shushukshma, which means that all the qualities that the Lord has, the jiva also has them, but just in a very tiny way. But there are certain qualities that the living entity has that the Lord doesn't necessarily have, which are described in the previous verse. You know what those are? Okay, that's a good one. Is there any other qualities that the living entity has that the Lord does not have? Envy? not eternally conscious of all living entities. They're both eternally conscious, because that's okay. So that's another one. That's... Okay, yeah, that's another one. Okay, yeah. So there's certain. A lot of these points were talked about in the. Some of the points were talked about in the previous. These are all good points. Another one is that the Lord is, or that the living entity is dependent, and the Supreme Lord is independent. And kind of along Ruktuk's point is that because the living entity is so small, it's almost like the living entity is powerless, whereas the Supreme Lord is all powerful. So then there's certain qualities that the Lord has that the living entity does not have, which is described in the previous verse. Can anyone remember, recall what qualities that the Lord had? If we could specifically think about the previous verse from yesterday, what qualities does the Lord have that the living entity does not have? Omniscience. Okay. Yeah. So an omniscient situation situated in everyone's heart. It's interesting because the way Prabhupada translates this verse and the next verse, he uses the living entity, the word the living entity. If you look at Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on these verses, he translated as the Lord. You know, because in the last verse it says, nonetheless, because he is extremely small, he is prone to be illusioned by the external energy, and thus he creates various bodies for himself according to different desires. Okay, well that makes sense. I'm thinking of the Supreme Lord being like the shelter of the living entities. The living entity is sheltered by the Lord, and the Supreme Lord is the shelter of other living entities. I guess that might have been more brought out in the purport. Or I guess the Supreme Lord being all-pervading. Yeah, anyway. Well, he could be a shelter. He could be like a conduit of the Lord's mercy to the conditioned souls. And in that way, he can be a shelter for some living entities. I don't think it makes sense that he would be the shelter for all the living entities. I mean, perhaps his being there can act like a upliftment for all the living entities. But the kind of, it's not that pure devotee is all pervading, that he's like within everything, he's supporting everything. But that pure devotee is a part of the Lord, I guess, who's kind of helping others. So in that sense, it depends on what sense you mean. Yeah, if you think of Guru being like the, it's just a manifestation of Krishna, then that makes sense. If you're thinking of it like that. And we also hear about the pure devotee being that, like, one of the constituents of the absolute truth are Krishna's pure devotees. Like the devotees are actually constituents of the absolute truth. So when we speak about Krishna, that also means Krishna, his paraphernalia, his devotees, that's all part of what we mean when we say Krishna. So in that sense, when we think of Krishna, we think of Krishna's pure devotees also, and in that sense, the pure devotee is everywhere. So it depends on what you're meaning when you say pure devotee is everywhere. Yeah. Okay, anyway, so I just thought that was interesting to point out, because the verse around today, text 10, says, "For this living entity, no one is dear, nor is anyone unfavorable. He is one without a second." In other words, he's not affected by friends or enemies. He's only an observer. The thing is, it almost seems like the living entity in this verse that's being described refers more to the Lord than it does to the living entity, especially when you look at Prabhupada's purport. Vishwanath Chakravarti says it's the Lord. And then the purport that Prabhupada, and Prabhupada uses Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary quite a bit. And it's just describing how the Lord is Samoham Sarvabhuteshu, how he doesn't envy anyone, he's not partial to anyone. And that's similar to what's being described in the verse, is that this living entity, he's not affected by friends and enemies. He's only an observer. And then the whole purport's just about the Lord. And it seems like the living entity that's being referred to in the verse is actually the Lord and not necessarily the jiva. Which, interesting little. Yeah, rock talk. Well, jivas are an expansion of Krishna in a sense. Jivas are an expansion of an expansion of an expansion of an expansion or whatever, et cetera, of Krishna. So Krishna has unlimited expansions, some of which are the jivas, some of which are his personal expansions, some of which are energy expansions. So he has different kinds of expansions and they're all unlimited, and one of those categories is jiva. Okay, so I thought I'd just clarify that before going on, that the list, this living entity, it seems like it's more referring to the Lord than it is to the jiva in this particular verse. Okay, so now we're talking about the Lord, how the Lord. It's interesting how Prabhupada describes the Lord as, how in the purport he said, the Lord is extremely antagonistic toward those who are envious of his devotees. And then he's very inclined to his devotees. So when it comes to the Lord dealing with his devotees, he cares. He gets involved. He takes it personally. He reacts. But when it comes to other living beings who are not his devotees aren't so much involved, he's more or less neutral. He's a witness. He observes it. But he's more or less kind of aloof from everything. So the example here was given of the Lord dealing when the, in a example of him kind of being extremely antagonistic to like demons. He gave the example of Prahlad and Hiranyakashipu, how Hiranyakashipu was messing with Prahlad, so the Lord was extremely antagonistic against Hiranyakashipu and tore him apart. Yeah, I mean, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that however you surrender unto him, he reciprocates with you accordingly. So if you're worshiping the Lord like in other religious traditions, and the Lord will reciprocate with them accordingly. So they're all, you can consider them devotees in one sense, because they are approaching the Supreme Being in some form. So Hiranyakashipu and Prahlad, that's a good example of how he's inclined to Prahlad and he's antagonistic toward Hiranyakashipu. And when it comes to, I'm just thinking of other examples, like we hear the famous example of Prabhupada and Mr. Nair. Some people might be familiar with this pastime of, I guess Mr. Nair was causing Prabhupada and the devotees a lot of trouble in Juhu. I guess they were trying to, I don't know, acquire some land for the temple there, and Mr. Nair was really difficult person to deal with, and it consumed a lot of Prabhupada's time and energy, this person. And then at one point, some of the devotees read a newspaper article that said, A.B. Nair is dead. And so then they're like, oh, you know, devotees were kind of like thinking, oh, that's kind of nice. And then they immediately tried to tell Prabhupada, hey, Prabhupada, Mr. Nair's dead. And then Prabhupada said, Jai, Hare Krishna. And, you know, because he was also very happy to see. And then Prabhupada actually said to the devotees in one letter that Nrisingadev killed Mr. Nair just like because he was so demoniac, like Hiranyakashipu, that Nrisingadev killed him. And that when scorpions and snakes are killed, that Vaishnavas take pleasure in that. So if it is true that Mr. Nair is dead, then all the devotees all around the world should rejoice. So it's another example of how the Lord might be antagonistic to Mr. Nair and inclined to his devotees, Prabhupada. And then we were just in this teacher's training course, we were just hearing another pastime where Krishna was entering Mathura and this washerman came up, or no, Krishna came up to this washerman who just dyed King Kamsa's clothes, nice silk clothes and everything. And then Krishna asked the washerman, hey, can I have those? And the washerman said, no. And he's very offensive. And he said, these are King Kamsa's clothes. I'm going to throw you in jail. And he was saying all kinds of offensive things. So then Krishna just kind of, you know, punched him and beheaded him and killed him right on the spot. So he can be pretty antagonistic if Krishna doesn't, you know, doesn't like you, or especially if you mess with his devotees. But sometimes even if you just mess with him, he can be really antagonistic to you. And then the other example was of the florist, you know, because while Krishna was also entering Mathura, he also came across the florist, Sudama, who was super devoted and very nice, and Krishna reciprocated with him very nicely, went to his home, allowed the florist to garland him, and it was a very sweet exchange. So like that, he's very inclined to his devotees and antagonistic toward it, the demons or those who are enemies of his devotees. Yeah, Jeremy? For most people, yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, that's a good point, is that that gives us more impetus to really not offend devotees, because otherwise Krishna might punch our head off. Yeah, because we are surrounded by devotees, so that's important. We don't want to offend them, because Krishna doesn't like that. And ultimately, we want to please Krishna, and we want to go to the spiritual world, and can't, you know, we got to stop doing these offenses and do some. Oh, of course, yeah. Sure, yeah. That's right. That's right. So, talking about Jeremy's point about the Lord being kind of just witnessing it, witnessing most people, just kind of neutral, kind of just. The Lord doesn't really get involved so much with the activities of most living entities. He's pretty preoccupied enjoying in the spiritual world with the gopis and the gopas, that he doesn't really get so much involved with most of the living entities here in the material world. He kind of lets his personal expansion, Paramatma, or other expansions deal with that. The personal expansions, they might, you know, give out the sinful and pious actions and reactions all to all the living entities, but it's not that Krishna's personally involved, so to speak. So Jai Jagannath was giving a really interesting class some time ago about Krishna's kind of aloofness from the material world, and even conditioned souls, and even souls, conditioned souls in here in the material world, how Krishna's kind of aloof from them. And he brought up a point from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur that he raises the question, well, if Krishna is so preoccupied enjoying in the spiritual world with the gopas and the gopis, then who hears the prayers of the Raganuga Bhaktas? We're praying, or if you're a pure devotee, you're praying. Krishna is preoccupied in the spiritual world, so who's hearing the prayers if Krishna is busy doing something else? This is one of the questions that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur raises. So the answer is that ultimately it is Krishna, because Krishna is omniscient, so he can simultaneously both hear the prayers of the Raganuga Bhaktas and simultaneously engage in his sweet pastimes in the spiritual world. Yeah, Krishna can do that, multitask. Well, it's interesting because when it comes to Krishna's pure devotees, like particularly the way it's described by Vaishnava Chakravarti Thakur, the Sharanagatas, those who are fully surrendered to Krishna, Krishna hears those prayers. So for pure devotees, Krishna personally hears those prayers and he reciprocates. But when it comes to others who are not necessarily Sharanagatas, pure devotees of the Lord, they might be praying, but it might not necessarily mean that Krishna himself personally is hearing those prayers. He might be hearing it through his expansions, like the Paramatma, or through some other agent, but it's not necessarily Krishna himself, Swayam Rupa Krishna, who's necessarily hearing those prayers, because it's described that Krishna himself only hears the prayers of the Sharanagatas, those who are fully surrendered to him. So we might hear this, and some of us might feel a little discouraged. That's Krishna's not hearing my prayers. So that's it should actually be encouraging, because it kind of forces us to become Krishna conscious in a way. The idea, the way Jai Jagannath put it very beautifully, he said that because it forces us to become a part of Krishna's world as opposed to Krishna becoming a part of our world. So he gave the example of like a boy trying to get the popular girl. The girl's kind of way out of his league, and the boy is trying to get with this girl. So he has to think about ways that he could get her attention, and he has to kind of remove himself from the center of his own consciousness, and he has to put that girl that he's trying to get in the center of his consciousness. And the boy, he has to kind of become a part of her world, find out what her interests are, what she likes, if he's at all wanting to get with her. So we can understand that at least. So like that, if we're trying to get with Krishna, we have to get out of the center of our own consciousness, and we have to put Krishna in the center of our consciousness, and we have to kind of become a part of his world. And in that way, we can kind of become Krishna conscious, and that way Krishna will actually pay attention to us and hear our prayers. And so Krishna's, because the girl, in relation to this boy and girl analogy, the girl's more or less unconcerned with the boy. So the boy has to do something to kind of get the girl's attention. And to so similarly, Krishna, it's somewhat like that in the sense that Krishna is kind of a little bit unconcerned, because he's solely self-satisfied. He's enjoying in the spiritual world, so he's not so much concerned with the conditioned souls, personally, himself. So it's up to the living entities to be able to kind of make Krishna concerned for him, in a sense. So then, during this class, Raktak asked a nice question. He said, "Well, but I thought Krishna wanted us to go back to the spiritual world more than he wanted us to go back." I thought that was a really good question. I don't know if you remember asking that. So how do we understand that? Here, Krishna is totally unconcerned about us. But then we hear statements like this, that Krishna wants us to go back to the spiritual world more than we want to go back. So it is true that Krishna is concerned with us. He sends his avatars. He gives us facility for coming back to him in the form of shastras and everything. But generally when we hear that Krishna is enjoying in the spiritual world with the gopis 24 hours a day, and it tends to give us like a feeling of envy, like kind of brings about our envious nature that, oh, Krishna's enjoying. Here Krishna is enjoying all day, and here I am suffering like anything in the material world. So that kind of, and he doesn't even seem to care about our suffering here in the material world. What about all the suffering going on here? Why doesn't he care about us? So the idea is that Krishna does care about us, but he cares for us, or he's concerned about us through his devotees, as Jayanish was kind of hinting at earlier, is that the devotees are everywhere in one sense, and Krishna is concerned about the living entities, the conditioned souls, through his pure devotees. As I said earlier, devotees are constituents of the absolute truth. So Krishna is concerned through those pure devotees, because the pure devotees are very concerned with bringing the conditioned souls from their conditioned state to a perfected state. And they're really concerned with that. And that is how Krishna is concerned. Otherwise, he himself is enjoying in the spiritual world. So it's interesting also to kind of note that which devotees Krishna chooses to give his mercy through to the conditioned souls. Like, so for example, sometimes there's a misconception, or people criticize ISKCON, and they say that if you're not like a nitya siddha, like an eternally liberated devotee, you cannot be a bona fide spiritual master. Sometimes there's this criticism out there. Some devotees have this conception that unless the spiritual master is a nitya siddha, eternally liberated, perfected soul, he cannot, he's not bona fide. He can't really help someone really come, you know, perfect his life. This isn't exactly the proper understanding the way we're taught. In fact, if you think about, if you compare nitya siddhas and sadhana siddhas are those who reach perfection through sadhana, who are not eternally liberated, but who are conditioned and then who attained perfection. So if you compare nitya siddhas with sadhana siddhas, it's actually, nitya siddhas are kind of almost at a disadvantage in one sense for helping conditioned souls to perfect their lives, because the nitya siddhas are, they're so much intensely feeling bliss at all times eternally. It's like super intense, compact bliss. It's like a really dense metal, the way Jai Jagannath was describing. It's like a really dense metal that the sufferings or the miseries of the conditioned souls, it can't penetrate them because they're enjoying so much they can't really understand or relate with or understand the plight of the conditioned souls because they don't have that experience. So that's why Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that it's actually that Krishna distributes his mercy to the conditioned souls through the Madhyama Bhaktas, who might not necessarily be Nitya Siddhas, they might be Sadhana Siddhas. Because the Madhyama Bhaktas, they're actually more perhaps equipped to be conduits of the Lord's mercy, because they know what it was like to be conditioned, and they know what it was like to come out of that conditioning to a perfected state. So they're able to almost better understand the plight of the conditioned souls and then elevate them up out of it, because they can understand, they were there, they know what it's like, and they know how to get to the perfected state. Yeah, Jaya Nishna. Yeah, but yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, like Prabhupada isn't. Right. So that's an interesting point. I don't know if I know the answer to give it fully. I don't know if I know the answer. I just know that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur did say that he does the Lord does distribute his mercy through the Majjhima Bhaktas. So it could be the Uttama Bhaktas, the Nitya Siddhas that just play the role of Majjhima Bhaktas to be able to distribute his mercy. So that could be the case too, because you're right, because that makes sense that the Nitya Siddhas, they do have the, we've seen that the impact that they have on elevating so many souls to the spiritual world. So that's a good point. I'll just say that's a good point. Well, if they're sadhana siddhas, they might remember what it was like to be a conditioned soul. They might think of it like if you have a nightmare, you kind of remember a little bit that, okay, I had a nightmare, I kind of remember what it was like. Now I'm awake and I'm normal or whatever. So like someone who's liberated, they might be in a perfected liberated state, but they remember what it was like to be in a conditioned state. But we're talking about nitya siddhas, eternally liberated souls. No, they never had anything to do with being conditioned in the material world. So a lot of we believe that a lot of our acharyas were nitya siddhas. They're eternally liberated. They were asked to come to the spiritual world, or they came to this or sorry, they were come to the material world for the purpose of this Krishna consciousness movement, for the purpose of hell bringing souls to the spiritual platform. So this is how Krishna is concerned with the conditioned souls here in the material world, is that he sends his devotees, sometimes Nitya Siddha devotees, sometimes Sadhana Siddhas, to elevate the devotees, the conditioned souls, from where they are to the spiritual world. But that's how Krishna does it. Krishna himself, though, is not personally concerned as such. But Chayanisha gave a good point, so makes sense. Paramakruna. Some of them, some of the gopis were sadhana siddhas, or were conditioned, and they became gopis through, devotional service. But then there are the nitya siddha gopis, and in the spiritual world, they're actually, there's this pastime, I don't remember all the details of the pastime, where they actually, Krishna wanted to just enjoy with the nitya siddhas, the nitya siddha gopis, and because there's like billions and tons of gopis, and sometimes when they all come to do the rasa dance, it's like it's nice, everybody's enjoying like anything, but sometimes Krishna just wants to enjoy with certain gopis and not a billion gopis all at the same time. So sometimes the Krishna he has special rasa dances with only the nitya siddhas, only the nitya siddha gopis, and the sadhana siddha gopis there, they enjoy it other times. So there is a difference even in the spiritual world. I would have to look up all the story to. Yeah, I'd have to look at that. I don't remember hearing that. That's interesting. Lalita said that she was She might. It's not necessarily that she was conditioned and then she became a Nitya Siddha. Okay, so that's different. But then Jai Jagannath was making the point. I think you raised a question or something about Nitya Siddha and Sadhana Siddha. I think you might have even asked the same question, and then Jai Jagannath said there was one purport where it's possible that like devotees like Prahlad Maharaj or other certain devotees, they're both Sadhana Siddha and Nitya Siddha simultaneously. I don't know where that is, and we'd have to look more into it, but that could reconcile perhaps some of these, that question that you asked, and that confusion is that there's a possibility of one being both Nitya Siddha and Sadhana Siddha. Don't ask me to explain that, but that possibility is there. Okay, is there any other questions or comments? Yeah, I'm concluding now, so unless anybody has anything, then we'll stop here.
Determined that the living entity refers to Supreme Personality Godhead, but I'm just curious, in other commentaries, perhaps there's sometimes the acharyas have different understandings.
So I didn't give us, I just said that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he says that this living entity refers to the Lord. And Prabhupada, I'm just basing, and then Prabhupada's purport, it's almost, the purport describes mostly the Lord when he's referring to all the qualities that are mentioned in the verse itself. So it almost seems like that this living entity does refer to the Lord. There might be other commentaries that I'm not aware of where that this living entity refers to the jiva, but I haven't seen those. No, there's disagreements all over in the if you read the commentaries, you'll see certain acharyas, they disagree with other acharyas about like little detailed points. For example, like Pradyumna. And who is Pradyumna? He's like a member of the Chaturvyuha, but yet he's also Krishna's son in Dwarka, or son. And at one point, in one commentary, Prabhupada says that Pradyumna is a Vishnu tattva, and then in another place, Prabhupada says that Pradyumna is in the category of jiva tattva or some other kind of tattva. And like this, if you scrutinize the scriptures and the commentaries by the acharyas, you'll see all kinds of contradictions and things that aren't necessarily all consistent, seemingly. So one way that we can kind of approach the idea of there being contradictions among the acharyas is first to kind of broaden our vision of the topic. Trying to think of an example, because they're just seeming contradictions. When you actually like look at it, especially from a not a conditioned soul point of view, they're not really any contradictions. But from our point of view, because we don't understand the bigger picture, it just seems like there's contradictions, and we just don't know how to reconcile the differences. But if you like, there's lots of examples where it might seem like there's, oh, this is directly contradicting something else I've heard. But then if you step back and you get more knowledge from other places, you actually understand, oh, okay, now I understand why this one said this and why this one said this, and okay, now it makes sense because I have more knowledge like that. Sometimes acharyas disagree just because that's their bhav. Like, they might say that, I don't know, Krishna is the best or something because they're in Krishna's camp, and then other devotees might say, no, Radharani is the best. It seems like a contradiction. There can only be one best. But it's just because that's their bhav. That's how they feel about certain things. So there's a difference between objective, absolute reality, how things are, and one's feelings towards a certain topic. So oftentimes you'll see acharyas, when they're making commentaries, their feelings or their bhav comes out, and they might say things which is just directly contradicting something that another acharya says, because the other acharya might have some other bhav, some other way of relating with Krishna, and they're both true. But it's like a rasa kind of thing. So you have to really get into each contradiction and kind of really delve into it to kind of figure out whether it's just like a bhav contradiction, or if it's just a, I don't have enough knowledge, therefore it doesn't seem to make sense and I need to get more knowledge to be able to reconcile it, or something. But generally we understand that there is no contradictions. It's just apparent contradictions. Is that okay? Okay, anything else? Okay, we'll end here. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.